Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matt Southworth, an Iraq War veteran and board member of the group Veterans for Peace, who assesses President Obama's recent speech reframing U.S. counterterrorism policy. Coalition of Immokalee Workers organizer Gerardo Reyes-Chavez, who talks about the campaign by tomato pickers in Florida to pressure the Wendy's restaurant chain to sign onto the coalition's Fair Food program benefiting low-wage farm workers. And Occupy Our Homes activist Tim Franzen, who explains the goals of his group's recent civil disobedience protest at the U.S. Justice Department. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Apple CEO Tim Cook recently appeared before the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Investigations to defend a tax scheme which allows the company to avoid paying taxes on over $30 billion in profits by funneling it through a unit in Cork, Ireland, controlled by top Apple executives in California. According to Senate investigators, Apple Operations International has not filed a tax return in 5 years, even though it reported billions of dollars in revenue. Apple currently keeps over $100 billion in cash outside the United States, and Cook refused to return the funds to the U.S. unless the corporate income tax rate is radically cut. In London, Google CEO Eric Schmidt took heat over his company's tax avoidance from British labor leader Ed Miliband and Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg. Google used a tax avoidance strategy known as the Double Irish to direct foreign profits through Ireland and the Netherlands to Bermuda, which has no corporate income tax, thus saving Google over $2 billion in tax liability. Corporate tax avoidance strategies are coming under increased scrutiny from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, a think tank for developed nations. The European Union is also moving closer to ending bank secrecy, mandating the sharing of personal bank account information with other countries within the 27-nation bloc, with similar rules applied in tax havens like Switzerland. Seoul, South Korea is a dynamic city of 10 million people and a hub for new technology in the global economy. The nation boasts big corporate names like Samsung, LG, and Hyundai Motors. Today, Samsung is going head-to-head with Apple in the lucrative smartphones market. South Korea recently elected its first woman president, Park Geun-hye, a conservative politician and the daughter of former dictator Park Chung-hee, who was assassinated in 1979. During the 1970s, South Korea had a weak economy and was dependent on U.S. aid. The nation turned itself around by adopting the Asian development model, exporting consumer electronics and automobiles. As the economy has surged over the last 15 years, unemployment never rose above 4%, and per capita annual income is now over $30,000. But there is a downside to this economic dynamism. South Koreans' new obsession with affluence and status has produced high household debt, a housing bubble, and perhaps grimmest of all, the highest suicide rate per capita among the 34 nations in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Some observers speculate that as the potential for extreme affluence has risen, the shame associated with the failure to achieve it has also increased. And as traditional cultural mores have given way to a new hyper-competitive social milieu, the pressure to succeed may be too great for many, especially South Korean youth. As one university professor put it, "Too many young people are very unhappy. If they don't succeed, they are devastated." For the first time, the United States has articulated a global water strategy, a move praised by civil society groups working with the poor. The new Water and Development Strategy, released by the U.S. Agency for International Development, focuses on boosting access to water for agriculture and sanitation services in poor nations. Its aim is to enhance water security across the globe, but some advocates for the poor fear aid could be diverted to wealthier nations. In poor and developing countries, the United Nations reports 2,000 children die every day from waterborne diseases such as diarrhea, mostly resulting from poor sanitation. The U.S. Congress adopted the Water for the Poor Act in 2005, but the law was never properly implemented and an action plan never emerged. Advocates are now pushing Congress to introduce and pass the new Water for the World Act, which would prioritize water and sanitation assistance to the poorest nations rather than those countries considered to be of strategic importance to U.S. foreign policy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In the midst of growing concern and questions surrounding the Obama administration's drone program targeting terrorist suspects abroad and a widespread hunger strike by detainees at the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the president addressed the nation in a speech at the Defense University in Washington, D.C. on May 23rd. While justifying the conduct of the U.S. war against terrorism under his watch, Mr. Obama called for the eventual repeal of the post-9/11-2001 authorization for the use of military force that he said promotes a perpetual wartime footing and may give presidents too much power. The president admitted and then defended the U.S. drone strikes that have killed four American citizens as he proposed tighter restrictions on the future use of drones to reduce civilian casualties. Mr. Obama also outlined his plans to make good on his unfulfilled 2008 campaign pledge to close the Guantanamo Bay prison by lifting his own moratorium of transferring detainees to Yemen and appointing a new senior envoy to negotiate the release of additional prisoners to other nations. At several points in the speech, peace activist Medea Benjamin of the group Code Pink interrupted the president to condemn the government's drone program, to which Mr. Obama responded by saying, although he disagreed with her, that woman is worth paying attention to. Congressional Republicans were predictably critical of the president's revamping of counterterrorism policy. Senator Saxby Chambliss, Republican of Georgia, declared, "The president's speech will be viewed by terrorists as a victory." Your reporter spoke with Matt Southworth, an Iraq War veteran and board member of the group Veterans for Peace, who takes a critical look at President Obama's recent speech reframing U.S. counterterrorism strategy.
The president's speech was both disappointing and sort of impressive. He spoke at times with candor. And so there is a group of people for which no matter what the president says on these policies, it'll never be good enough. And when I listen, and that's both Republican and Democrat, Libertarian, you know, the whole lot. And when I listen to the president speak, I heard a lot of things that he said that, to me, to my mind, weren't accurate. The first I'd take on is to say that the president essentially said he had this premise that using drones and these counterterrorism policies would somehow prevent future civilian casualties. And I think that is counterfactual, meaning that you can't prove it because it relies on things that haven't happened yet to prove that it's true. So now, to be fair, what I say about why the U.S. shouldn't use drones is the fact that we will radicalize people, and not just drones, but war in general will radicalize people, push people further to the fringes of their own culture and societies, and create and foment this anti-American sentiment. Now, what I have that President Obama doesn't have is a Yemeni activist and many, many others, but most notably a Yemeni activist who recently testified to Congress, to the Senate Judiciary Committee, that the drone strikes in his village had done more to radicalize people in Yemen than al-Qaeda propaganda ever had. This is Faria al-Muslimi, who's, again, a Yemeni journalist and activist. So that's one thing. I think, you know, the president's counterterrorism policy based on this premise that we, by engaging in these military maneuvers, we are somehow preventing future conflict or greater civilian casualties, I think it's just false, and it's a highly flawed assumption. The other thing I'd say, the president said that Congress exercises oversight and that Congress is briefed on every drone strike. Well, that's not completely true. The DOD does voluntarily brief, and the CIA does voluntarily brief certain members of Congress on certain committees, most notably the House and Senate Armed Service and the House and Senate Intelligence or the Joint Select Intelligence Committee. But the vast majority of Congress, you know, right there you're talking about maybe 100 members or so altogether. The vast majority of Congress, House and Senate, does not receive briefings on these drone strikes. And by the way, when the people who are briefed get their briefing, they're sworn to secrecy because it's all top secret. So it's not like they can go and sit in a room somewhere and talk about this with other members. This is really a very small group of people who know about these things. So that, again, is highly problematic and is not an indicative of true oversight. You know, and the last thing I would say is that the president dropped a lot of important language from this aspect of his counterterrorism speech that he had had before. In the past, the administration has said they only use lethal force on key al-Qaeda leaders. And McClatchy News actually did a really good debrief of this. The president dropped that key leadership of al-Qaeda language completely and only named associated forces. Now, the authorization of the use of military force, or AUMF, which was passed in 2001, authorizes the president to take action against nations harboring or affiliates, people who conducted the terrorist attacks on 9/11. Over the last 4, 5, 6 years or so, we've seen this policy morph into al-Qaeda not only in Afghanistan, but al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, al-Qaeda in Iraq, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, groups that aren't associated with al-Qaeda like al-Shabaab in Somalia, and a handful of other places. And these groups are typically known as associated forces, which is to say, as far as we know, there are no clear links to al-Qaeda, the actual organization, but ideological affiliation. And effectively, what this comes down to, this associated forces language, comes down to the fact that the president has used the AUMF, the 2001 law, to justify military action all over the world in just about any place that they deem fit, as long as there's an associated force and an imminent threat. And imminent means that essentially the administration doesn't need evidence, and imminent can be any period of time. Senator Angus King from Maine, in the Armed Service Committee hearing a week ago on the AUMF, really took down administration witnesses on this. He said that you've essentially made up the language associated forces. So all of this was contained in this very long, very complex speech. And what it really comes down to is that these flaws, three, and just three of many, are very substantial and I think need to be addressed not by just by Congress, but also by the administration.
Matt, the president also talked about closing the Guantanamo U.S. Naval Detention Center in Cuba. Do you think this is just rhetoric, or do you think this time the president and his administration will move substantively to close that facility?
You know, I think the administration actually made moves early on to start transferring detainees out of Guantanamo. They moved a number of prisoners out. Really, since the start of the Obama administration, there were 242 prisoners in Guantanamo. Right now, there are about 166. So the president has made moves. I think Congress made that much more difficult. The Republican Party in the House, particularly on the Armed Service Committee, made it incredibly difficult for the president to transfer current detainees to Yemen and other countries or to the United States. The president does have the authority to take more action than he has. You know, I don't sit inside the office, but I'm not sure if it's because of political reasons or for some other reason. The president has been slow on this, but I think the president could definitely move a little faster. From my point of view, it is morally reprehensible that some of these people who have been essentially acquitted are still locked up in prison to the point that they are so hopeless, they're engaged in a hunger strike, literally putting their lives on the line because of all they have left. I've read the bios and some of these articles, and it's really just heart-wrenching. I was pleased to see the president using his executive powers to lift some of the transfer memoranda on detainees toward Yemen. I think those are all positive steps in the right direction. I think history will look back on Guantanamo Bay as a really dark part of the U.S. history in this global war on terror. There are a lot of dark places, but that's going to be a particularly dark one.
That was Matt Southworth, an Iraq War veteran, board member of the group Veterans for Peace, and legislative associate with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Find links to Southworth's recent articles on U.S. wars abroad by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the past 8 years, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers has reached agreements with 4 of the top 5 largest fast food restaurant chains, Taco Bell, McDonald's, Burger King, and Subway, and 7 others, to join the coalition's Fair Food Program, which covers 90% of the tomato industry in Florida. The program commits the companies to pay an extra penny a pound for tomatoes, which is then passed directly on to the workers. The funds collected in the program over the past several years has totaled $10 million. The agreement also guarantees accurate accounting of work hours, health and safety protections, and zero tolerance for sexual harassment and slavery, both of which have been major problems in the tomato fields. The Workers' Coalition has been recognized for its anti-slavery work, resulting in the emancipation of more than 1,000 workers who were being held captive in deplorable conditions. Wendy's restaurant is the only one of the top five restaurant chains not to have signed on to the Fair Food Program, so members of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or CIW, and their supporters held a rally in New York City in a press conference on May 23rd outside the Sofitel Hotel in Manhattan, where the Wendy's annual shareholders meeting was taking place. One of the speakers was farm worker and CIW organizer Gerardo Reyes Chavez, who recounted the long struggle of the Immokalee tomato pickers in Florida and the intransigence of Wendy's in ignoring calls to sign on to the coalition's Fair Food Program in bettering the lives of farm workers. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the press conference and recorded Chavez's comments.
I want to start by saying thanks to everyone for being here and to mention the importance of this historic program, the Fair Food Program, the importance of the historic moment in which we are today, with all the changes taking place in the tomato industry of Florida. 12 years ago, it was just a dream that the farm worker community had, that one day we will be changing the conditions that existed for too long, conditions of abuse, conditions where workers' dignity was constantly being stepped on, conditions that are changing today because of the implementation of the program that the farm workers created. The Fair Food Program is a unique collaboration between workers, tomato producers, corporations that are participating to ensure better wages and working conditions in Florida tomato fields and implementing a zero tolerance policy for situations of slavery and sexual harassment. 11 corporations have signed, including Taco Bell, McDonald's, Burger King, Subway, among others, committing their purchases under the Fair Food Program and working with 90% of the tomato industry in the state. Corporations are paying a premium pay to address sub-poverty wages and conditioning their purchasing on the implementations of rights for farm workers in the tomato supply chain. To talk a little bit about the case of slavery that was mentioned by my co-worker. In this case, this worker complained for being sexually harassed by her boss. When she complained, the tomato company refused to take action right away. So the buyers that have signed, that were buying tomatoes from that company, called and said, you have to fix this problem right away if you want to keep in business with us. When that happened, the company right away called back the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and the problem was fixed. This crew leader, who was the main person for hiring people for this company, was fired. A situation that had never happened before until the application of the Fair Food Program. Thanks to the Fair Food Program, no women and no worker, when they complain, have to give up their dignity to be able to just feed their kids. It is something that's changing today. Another example that's very powerful, it's when a worker, an older worker, was asked what was the most important thing for him in terms of the changes happening because of the program. He said, I have spent my entire life in the fields and I have seen kids become adults in the tomato rows. I have never seen the tomato industry treat us with respect until now. Thanks to the Fair Food Program, now they don't treat us like dogs. If Wendy's was the buyer for the farms where these abuses happen, the only thing that would happen there would be business as usual. Wendy's would not do anything because they have not signed these important agreements and they are not supporting the changes. Very interesting fact. In 2005, when Taco Bell signed this agreement for Fair Food, Taco Bell was the first company, and John Brands, its parent company, signed for them. Mr. Emil Brolik came up publicly saying in a statement, he said, as an industry leader, we're pleased to lend our support to and work with the CIW to improve working and pay conditions for farm workers in the Florida tomato fields. He continues saying, we have indicated that any solution must be industry-wide. as our company simply does not have the clout alone to solve the issues raised by the CIW. Since that moment until now, 10 other corporations have signed, and we have a question for Mr. Broly. If the solution to decades of abuse must be, as Mr. Broly proclaimed in 2005, industry-wide, why has Wendy's thus far ignored farm workers' call to participate in the Fair Food Program? Is Mr. Broly and the company that now he's leading as a CEO and president, Wendy's, willing to play a leadership role once again and help its company to meet the high human rights standards being implemented by others in the industry today? That is the question that we hope to get an answer for today. Thank you.
That was farm worker and Coalition of Immokalee Workers organizer Gerardo Reyes Chavez speaking at a May 23rd press conference. Learn more about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Occupy Wall Street movement, born in New York City's Zuccotti Park, a stone's throw from the world's most powerful financial district, spread like wildfire around the U.S. and the world in the fall of 2011. While coordinated police raids and arrests broke up the original protest site 2 months later and hundreds of other encampments around the nation, Occupy organizing continues, but mainly below corporate media's radar. Among the many campaigns that have been ignited by the Occupy movement are Occupy Sandy, a well-organized response to the deadly hurricane that struck the East Coast in October 2012, Strike Debt, that raises consciousness and funds to purchase and forgive debt, and Occupy Our Homes, a campaign challenging government inaction on the foreclosure crisis. Hundreds of protesters with Occupy Our Homes in a group called the Home Defenders League organized protest actions targeting the U.S. Justice Department in Washington, D.C., May 18th through the 23rd. Engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience, protesters blocked the entrance of the Justice Department building and traffic outside beginning on May 20th. The activists, many of them homeowners facing foreclosure, protested the failure of Attorney General Eric Holder to prosecute any bank executives for the reckless and fraudulent practices that cost millions of Americans their jobs and left families and communities ravaged by a foreclosure crisis and epidemic of underwater mortgages. In all, more than 30 Occupy Our Homes activists were arrested during the action, many refusing to give their names, instead giving police the names of big bank executives. Your reporter spoke with Tim Franzen, an organizer with the Atlanta chapter of Occupy Our Homes, who was arrested during the Washington protest while dealing with his own home foreclosure. Here he explains the group's anger at Attorney General Holder for declaring that big banks are too big to fail or jail, and the goals of the protest.
We know that 2012 is actually a very harsh year for homeowners. There's almost $192 billion of wealth that was lost from low-income communities, so people are hurting. And so there was an abundance of folks that were willing to come to D.C., learn how to build a housing justice group in their community, and take very risky, bold, direct action at the Capitol in front of the DOJ. And we found that there was about 1,000 other people that wanted to do it but couldn't afford to come, you know, because you're talking about folks that are in a pretty serious crisis. When people are going through this crisis, they can't drop everything. So for every person that did come and risk arrest, there was certainly thousands that were sort of there in spirit.
When you held your protest action at the Department of Justice, what were your demands and how many were arrested over the couple of days of the protest?
Well, the demands were pretty straightforward. Jail the bankers, and we need policy in this country that prioritizes homeowners over bankers. And what we have gotten over the last 5 years since the crisis hit is the exact opposite. We, of course, are all aware of this sort of statement or sentiment that the government put out that the banks are too big to fail. You know, they crashed the global economy with irresponsible policies, and our government's reaction to that is like, well, we can't let these guys fail. So they get this huge bailout of $800 billion, and the Federal Reserve is pumping money into the banks to the tune of $16 trillion, more than enough to buy every American a home free and clear. And now, in 2013, it is a knowable, provable fact that the banks used racial profiling in redline communities for their predatory loans. It is a knowable fact, an undeniable fact, even the banks don't deny it, that they used forgery, felony fraud, as a regular policy to get people out of their homes quicker. And, you know, despite the harm that's been caused to millions of Americans who've already lost their homes, and millions more that are going to lose their homes, and many that are severely underwater, like myself, Eric Holder, who's in charge of, who oversees the Department of Justice, said that it would be too complicated to indict these bankers, essentially putting out a policy of too big to jail. So, you know, folks are enraged, and this is a policy that was challenged last week. We think that if the banks aren't indicted, if the banks aren't jailed, then this is going to be something that continues to happen, as we see. And there's no incentive for banks to change their behavior.
Tim, we have just about a minute left, but tell us, what's the next steps in the campaign in order to create greater public awareness of the continuing problem with foreclosures and the solutions that you're demanding?
Well, this action at D.C. wasn't just about a protest. It was also, you know, we did a Housing Justice Academy, and our next step is to build up housing justice groups in about 50 or 60 new communities. And that's really our next step, is to start lifting up the stories of folks that are struggling right now, fighting to save their homes. And we're going to go back to D.C. and quadruple our numbers. And we may need to take on bigger targets. So I would encourage folks to go to occupyhomes.org and see how you can plug in. If you have a story or you need help, we have a way to help you. Check out the site, explore it. You can launch a petition. You can, you know, email. You can find out groups that are close to you. You can even start a group yourself.
That was Tim Franzen with the Atlanta chapter of Occupy Our Homes and an organizer of the civil disobedience actions at the U.S. Justice Department. For more information on the Occupy Our Homes campaign, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.